This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
I'm going to read some selections and make some comments on a section of Shobo Genzo called Hikamyoju, One Bright Pearl, from Volume 1 of the Shobo Genzo. But I'd like to introduce it with some general thoughts I've been having about Sesshin and Oriyoki and Passover. My son the other day told me that his mother took him to a very Orthodox Passover Seder that I think he said began around 6 or 7 in the evening and went till maybe 1 in the morning. There wasn't any food served till after 11. And the people who were conducting this ceremony put great energy and took great pleasure in going over every detail of the traditional Seder, which, as you may know, has the form, at least in part, of the youngest member of the family asking, what is the meaning of this ritual? Why do we do this? And what is it all about? And the very form of the ceremony is supposed to be about the transmission of a certain kind of history and ritual from one generation to the next. As far as I could tell, what was transmitted to my son in that case was a sense that he never wanted to have anything to do with this kind of thing again, right? Which is a problem, you know. It's funny in a way, but if you want to think about cultural transmission, you have to do it in a way that doesn't completely alienate the people you're trying to transmit to. And a few days later, Jessica and I hosted another version of a Seder, which somehow we got Sam to attend. And we specifically tried to address this with him of if you yourself are now in the position of running a Seder, what do you want to do with it? I said, you know, I myself spent many years sitting at long tables with old uncles and grandfathers who bored me to death with things I couldn't understand. And finally now, I'm the oldest person at this table, and I'm running the damn thing, and we can do what I say we're going to do. So what do I want to do with it, right? And so we try to address that at a Seder and ask, what are we going to do? We're in charge now. We're the grown-ups. But it's very much our situation here in the Zendo as well. We're the grown-ups and we're in charge, so what do we want to do? And I feel that way when we do Orioke together. It's something I would like us to have some feel for and pass along. But I want to do it in a way that basically we enjoy. That we feel that there is some point and some pleasure in having a meal in that kind of semi-formal way, in which we pay attention to each detail of how we do things, where there's clearly a right and wrong way to do it, but in an atmosphere where it doesn't make that much difference if you do it wrong, right? And yet we try to do it right. How right and how we make that happen is part of the feeling of Sesshin, which itself has been restructured by me to be a Sesshin I want to attend. You know, I've sat through a lot of very long, hard sesshins, some of which, you know, including some with Joko, that I would never want to do again, and I do not want to inflict on anybody else. And when I started this place, I said, all right, I'm the grown-up now. I'm writing the schedule. What do I want to do? And the format we use here is a schedule that was designed to make Sesshin less about physical endurance and more about being able to have a certain amount of silence and concentration and discipline, more than we're going to do on our own. Most people are not going to regularly sit 8 hours a day by themselves. But to create a structure where we can do that together, but where there's not a lot of physical agony or endurance or pressure or shouting or hitting people with a stick to make it happen, right? We're doing it in a way that we have to decide we want to do. Now, you know, the old guys who do the Passover Seder that lasts, you know, after midnight, are pretty convinced that what they're doing is preserving something in its original form for the next generation. And that whatever I did at a Seder table is watering it down so much that it's going to disappear in the next generation or two. And what we're doing here is probably viewed pretty much the same way by Sotoshu and the monks in Eheiji, right? We have to make a real decision about what do you think preserves something, right? Do you preserve it by doing it the way everyone has always done it? And when you inherit it, you made sure you keep it up exactly as best you can, the way it's always been done, and pass it along? Or do you modify it to make it relevant to yourself and the next generation and try to keep it alive that way? This is a very fundamental question for Zen in America, and I think about it all the time. And I hope that in some way you treat it as a real question issue for yourselves about what do you want to do when you feel responsible for this practice and this tradition? It's yours. What do you want to do with it? Which will bring me to Dogen. I think that this edition was originally published, I see, in 1975. I probably encountered it about 10 years later. I figure that I first read Dogen in the Francis Cook, How to Raise an Ox translation in abridgment. And I probably was reading that while I was a student at Bernie Glassman's, Greyston, in the 80s. And being an ambitious sort, I sought out the full unabridged translation. This was by Nishiyama and Stevens. And I did dutifully read all four volumes of this thing, which is some heavy going, and I'm sure that there's very little of it I understood then, or now for that matter. But this one chapter on One Bright Pearl, I remember standing out at the time. This is probably 30 years ago now, and it was one that I felt I could get and gave me a foothold in this book, and I believe also, as you'll hear, had a lot of resonance with what I would later understand from Joko. Now, I cannot really remember if Joko ever talked much about Dogen. I don't think she did. Somebody will probably go downstairs, look at Everyday Sen, and see she has a whole chapter on One Bright Pearl, which I've forgotten about entirely. But as far as I know, this is not something she ever talked about. But you'll see, I think, why it was sort of a bridge for me between what I was hearing from different teachers and how I began to put it together for myself. I'm going to just skip around in this chapter a little bit, so I'm not reading the whole thing and I don't keep you here to midnight. It is the story of Master Gensha, who takes his name from where he lived on Mount Gensha. The great master lived during the Song Dynasty. Before he became a monk, he was fond of fishing and took his boat to the Nandai River, where he learned fishing from various people. Surely, however, he did not expect to catch the golden fish of enlightenment that catches itself. When he was 30 years of age, he recognized the preeminence of the Buddhist way and suddenly decided to renounce this transient world. He left his boat and retired to the mountains, finally settling on Mount Seppo, where he became the disciple of the great master, who is known as Seppo. It's worth noting here that he lived a good portion of his life as a layman, as a fisherman, and only became a monk at age 30. This is very unusual. Dogen and most monks became monks as young teenagers, or young boys. Whole life was growing up in monasteries. Gensha practiced the way day and night. One day he decided to visit some other masters so he could further perfect his practice. He prepared his traveling bag and started out on his journey. But just as he was leaving the mountain, he stubbed his toe on a rock, began to bleed, and was extremely painful. But then, quite unexpectedly, he had a sudden self-realization. "This body doesn't exist," he cried. "Where is the pain coming from?" After he said this, he immediately returned to his master Seppo. It's an interesting thing to cry out. One imagines that he had had previously some kind of insight into the emptiness of things. This body does not exist. It must be something he had felt for himself, not just finally read in a sutra. And that he thought he sort of knew that truth of emptiness, and that he was going to go out on pilgrimages and, he says, sort of hone his knowledge. Maybe we'd say show off to other teachers, who knows. But he thought he had something to take around and work with. We could say probably that he had an experience that made him feel that the realization of emptiness granted him a certain kind of imperviousness, right? That he was in some state where he might be above it all. But when he stubbed his toe, he got a very real demonstration that that wasn't the case. And it provoked the kind of crisis realization where what he thought he knew up till that moment got shattered, but in a way that took him to a another level of understanding. So he came and went back to Seppo, told him what happened. Seppo asked him, "Did you go on pilgrimage just to cut your foot and have a bad time?" Genshe said, "Please don't kid me." Seppo was greatly pleased with that answer and told him, "What you just said should be spoken by everyone, but they lack your sincerity. Why don't you continue to visit other masters?" Genshe replied, "Bodhidharma didn't come to China and the second patriarch didn't go to India." Seppo praised this answer. So Genshe finally, when he says, "Please don't kid me," just speaks completely spontaneously. He's not talking in any way like a monk who is saying anything that's supposed to sound, like he sees through anything. He's just saying, "Come on, man, don't tease me. I just, my foot hurts like hell. I'm bleeding. Don't give me a hard time. Why don't you continue seeing other masters?" And basically he says, "I don't have to go anywhere now." Genshe was a fisherman for many years, and he had seen none of the voluminous sutras or commentaries, even in his dreams. But he put his earnest resolve above all else, and by his strong determination, excelled all other monks. Seppo considered him to be his best disciple. Genshe always wore a simple cloth robe full of patches, and beneath that he wore paper or monkwort cloth underwear. It's probably too much information. His only master was Seppo, and he never deviated from his master's dharma. After he attained the way, he used this saying to explain the Buddhist teaching: "The entire universe is one bright pearl." Once a monk asked him, "I've heard you teach that the entire universe is one bright pearl. How should we interpret that?" Genshe told him, "The entire universe is one bright pearl. What is there to interpret or understand?" Following day, the master himself questioned the monk, "The entire universe is one bright pearl. What's your understanding of that?" The monk replied, "The entire universe is one bright pearl. What is there to understand?" "You now know," said Genshe, "that even in the black mountain cave of demons, complete freedom is working. The essence of causality never ceases, and the pearl is always bright. It is our original face and enlightened eye. Hitherto there have been many notions of what the pearl is or is not, But now Genshe's words have clarified the pearl's true nature, which is actually our body and mind itself. How is it possible to doubt that life and death are also the bright pearl? Even if we are perplexed or troubled, it is nothing but the bright pearl. There cannot be any action or thought existing separately from the bright pearl. Consequently, even coming and going in the black mountain cave of demons is nothing but the one bright pearl. So that's how Dogen ends this section. And it's the part that I find very reminiscent of Joko, in ways that I'll explain. But the little exchange with the monk shows the monk trying to understand this saying. Genshe is trying to show him that this is not about understanding in a conventional sense. It's not about getting it or getting it right or getting it wrong. It's about drawing a circle around everything possible. Everything is inside this circle. Nothing is outside it. All is the one bright pearl. And that seeing it that way, it's not about understanding or not understanding. Not understanding itself is an aspect of the one bright pearl, is an aspect of life. So the monk comes back with a dumb parroting answer, not getting it, right? But trying to mimic what his master says. And the master comments on that, saying, well, you now know that even the black mountain cave of demons, complete freedom is working. It means even when you say something stupid like that, that's the one bright pearl too, right? Now, where I hear Joko in this is in the line, even if we're perplexed or troubled, it's nothing but the bright pearl. Joko really taught over and over again, seeing the absolute in every moment, regardless of its content, and particularly in the moments of emotional difficulty or emotional distress, when we're troubled or perplexed, right? Our usual sense of those states is that we want to get into their opposites. If we're troubled, we want to be untroubled. If we're perplexed, we want to have understanding. But her practice, and what Genshe is talking about here, is saying, see being troubled, see being perplexed as it, as the one bright pearl, as another aspect of your life. Right? When Genshe banged his foot on the rock, something happened that he realized that practice was not about understanding emptiness and getting into some state. It was about incorporating even banging your foot, bleeding like a stuck pig and crying out loud into the moment, into your realization of what he called one bright pearl. Now, the way I would like to tie this in to what I was saying before about Passover and tradition and sashim is Genshe was one of these guys who had a clear realization that he summed up in one line that he used over and over again. Whole universe is one bright pearl. I think when I read this, that sense that everything that happens is it, is the absolute. Find it there. Oh, yeah, I get that, right? I sort of, it was an idea that penetrated and I must have had some feeling for it because this chapter really stood out and it resonated with me and Joko later on. I think that in a way it's what we each have to find for ourselves. Very few of us are going to read through four volumes of the Shobogenzo and sort of find a gem in every one that becomes a touchstone for our practice. But it's pretty good if you find one, right? If you can find one pearl like this in the whole thing, you what you do is you make it a touchstone for your own idea of what practice is, right? For Joko in Gensha and me, in a certain way, it's that how do we say this is it to every kind of moment of experience, including these complex emotional ones, right? How do you work with yourself psychologically with that realization of staying with an experience rather than always trying to get out or reverse the ones that are negative, right? It's like one very basic good idea. He sums it up with this metaphor of the one bright pearl. In a sense, it's what realization means, crystallizing some understanding around one thing that you can then take into every situation, and you have your bearings with that, right? You know, too often these things get passed down as cliches. You have to find one, or better yet, make up one that sums up what practice is for you, what this tradition is for you, what you think we're doing here, that we say we're trying to hold and maintain. Right? What is it for you?